It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 207 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week you're going to enjoy a great conversation I had with Lovern Kanjursky, the creator of the Shame series of books from Renegade Arts Entertainment, and who has a new book out, a hardcover called Underworld, and it has a lot to do with the classic story, which we'll talk about during the interview. He discusses that this project was one that was a favorite of his, and he worked hard to make it happen, and what we can expect from the characters, and how a classic story can be relevant to today. He'll also talk a little bit about what's coming up from him, so you're certainly going to want to hear what he has to say. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. I want to welcome to the podcast Lovern Kanjursky, the creator of a great book that is just out from Renegade called Underworld. And Underworld is just out now, and it's a really fascinating story about a guy who thinks he's part of the Odyssey. And do you want to give us a little more description on that, Lovern?
Yeah, it's a guy who's escaped from the local loony bin, or correctly known as the psych ward. Mm-hmm. And he's pretty drugged up. When he went in, he was delusional because of life catching up with him. He's been playing fast and loose with a lot of games. He's an MLA who's been pushed into a position of power that he never really wanted by the overambitious father and, well, the pressures on being a man in today's world, which are sizable, I think.
Mm-hmm. It makes use of the Odyssey, is one of the things I really find interesting about it. And according to what I've been reading, you've got three themes in the book: the longing for home, the trials and tribulations of the world, and the powerful influence of fathers over sons.
Yep.
And my understanding is this reflects on your own experience. The guy's name is Hector Ashen, of course. And another thing I really like about the book is you use like photo references, and you're the photo reference for Hector Ashen.
That's me.
Which is really interesting. I don't see that very often in comics, so I was kind of intrigued by that. So why don't you talk a little bit about what it was like to pull this together? Because as I've done some research on this and been reading about it, it took a little doing to get this book to come out. So what did you have to do to make it happen?
Oh, boy. Standing on my head and juggling. I guess I shouldn't play that up too much. It was a project that I always wanted to see happen, and so it went through some different incarnations, and because I kept it in my back pocket, when it would come to a situation where there's a publisher or a situation where it could happen, I would push it forward again. Mm-hmm. But while it was there, it was going through some changes. The original name for Hector was actually Homer, but with the Simpsons there, I thought might not be a good idea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I went through incarnations of, I think at one point I was talking to a filmmaker friend of mine and looking at making it into a small art film. Mm-hmm. And making a small art film is quite a feat in itself. Mm-hmm. And I ran up against some walls and sort of backed off from that. And then I started a company called Digital Chameleon. Mm-hmm. And that took off like a house on fire. And that kept me very, very busy for a decade. And meanwhile, Underworld was floating around, and I would make some notes on it, change some things, maybe talk to somebody who I thought might be interested. Sometimes it might be talking to someone about making it as a graphic novel or a film, even considering the possibility of serializing it. And so it slowly was me nudging this thing along, finding a place for it to fit. Mm-hmm. And finally, when I was working with Renegade, and I had Shame well underway. Alexander was interested in what else that I have in mind, and so I pitched him a few things, and Underworld was one of them. And so it started happening, and it was going to be a book, and I started making the decisions then about nailing it down. And when I talked to Gregory about how we were going to work together in that, then that made a lot of decisions, and then we were off and running.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. Now, I loved Shame, by the way. I got to read that book, the series of books that you did, and I loved those. Those were great books.
Oh, thank you.
Just terrific stuff. And, of course, Alexander, who you mentioned, is Alexander Finville from Renegade Arts Entertainment. And one thing that I appreciate about Alex is that he does all kinds of wonderfully different and creative projects, and I include Underworld as one of those kinds of great projects, because comics tend to be superheroes or supernatural type things. But what you're doing is something very different from all the stuff I'm used to reading in Underworld. And so Alex has a wonderful ability to do that. And I've interviewed several of the folks from Renegade, because you guys always come up with something that is so different. And I love variety in my reading. So I want to congratulate you on doing that, for coming up for at least two projects that I know of that are really different and creative.
Oh, thank you.
And, of course, your partner in this is Greg. And how do you pronounce his last name?
It's Kamichuk.
Kamichuk. I knew I'd butcher that if I gave that a try. But yeah, he's the artist on this book, and you're the writer, and yep, you're the photo reference.
Yes, I'm the model.
Yeah, so really good. Does he use himself at all for any of the characters, or you?
No, he didn't. And when he first approached me to be the model for Hector, I said no. I didn't want people to see it as a vanity project. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I should think about it in that. And I did. And then the next time we got together, we were talking about it. And he told me that he had discussed it seriously with his wife, and that she felt that it was the right thing to use me for the model. And I was like, well, I'm less averse to that. And did she really? And it's like, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, she's got nothing in this besides, you know, it being some work for her husband. But just hearing that other point of view just made me change my mind. It was an odd kind of thing, but it's how it happened.
Now, I'm kind of interested, because you get to do all kinds of different expressions.
Oh, yeah.
Did you come up with the expressions? Did you and Gregory come up with that together? How did you decide what things you were going to do in certain panels of the book?
Well, we did this Marvel style. So I broke it down into pages, and I said, this is what has to happen on that page. I can see this three-panel sequence happening, but it's up to you. And it was. Mm-hmm. And so he would work out the stuff as he wanted. Mm-hmm. And as for the my expressions in that, we spent a couple of hours in a large photo studio doing everything from, I think at one point he had me recreating all the Steve Ditko poses I could remember and things like that. So he had a ton of photographs.
Okay.
And so it was, once he decided where he was going in that, he had a lot of choices to choose from. So
okay. So he didn't sit down and say, okay, you know, this such and page, we need you to pout kind of thing.
No. We tried to think of every kind of expression, and he would shoot it from several angles. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the camera was up a ladder. Sometimes I was up a ladder. Mm-hmm. And the story follows a real path through the city. Mm-hmm. And so we went and followed the path. And as we followed the path, in some of the shots were Gregory's photography of me in those places. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, he was taking shots of me from the photo session, mm-hmm, and dropping them into photos that he had taken of, from his European trip through, like, all of the antiquities that appear in there. That those are pictures of places that Gregory photographed himself when he was traveling. Mm-hmm. So there's no stock photo pictures in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I really like, too, about the way that you guys did this was that you had gone through some personal struggles as well. And it seemed that kind of helped you tune into the whole Odyssey story. And a thing I love about the whole business is that this is a reflection of modern days. If you have a classic story, people are basically the same as they've been for centuries. The kinds of things that are happening today are probably very similar to what's been happening in the last several centuries, with people going through loss, going through change of life, a change of perception, things like that. So that's one thing I really liked about this book was, of course, it's set in modern-day Winnipeg, which is, of course, where you guys live. And to see all this kind of thing happening and to realize that even when he's relating things out of the Odyssey, he's seeing things that are happening today. I really love that. I love a kind of a literate storytelling like you guys are doing. And to see him look at like a street or a car light and have him think it's the Cyclops and things like that. There's all kinds of interesting little allusions that, you know, you could see that people today, you may not think of those exact examples, but you get the idea that there are things that are influencing you that are probably similar to what we've seen in the past. So I really love the way you guys communicated that.
Oh, thank you. I think Greg did a really good job of understanding what I was trying to do, and his imagery was great, but also the way he was telling it, the flow of his pages. And that was something really important when I had to find an artist to tell the story, because I didn't want it to be broken down like some old six-panel grid kind of story. It needed to be more of an art book. Mm-hmm. And so Gregory being part of this was a really important choice.
Mm-hmm. I see from this, there's an article that was in the Winnipeg Free Press that I really liked that gave a lot of information I really appreciated. It was talking about the fact that you came up with this story back in the 1980s.
Yes.
You were in school at the time, and you had gone through like three losses in your life.
The big ones. My father, first I lost a career mm-hmm. as a printer. Mm-hmm. And decided that it had been a mistake and that art and creating had been my first love. So I lost my job and thought, well, I'm going to start right over again. I'm going to do it right. So I went to university and I was taking my Bachelor of Fine Arts. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, my father died. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, my wife asked me for a divorce. Mm-hmm. So it was like boom, 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 big life changes. And getting my head around the first one was difficult, but I kind of worked through it in that. But getting my head around the second one, I was like still spinning when the third one hit.
Wow. So you can understand that there was a part in the article that I really liked about the fact that you were talking about that you had mythology classes, and then you went to English classes and elements of film classes and stuff. So this project sort of followed you from class to class as you started to bring it together.
Yes. When you look at the archetypes like that, it's very much like what you said earlier about Oedipus losing his mother the way he did. Mm-hmm. Would probably affect him the same way today if he had found out that, oh, wait a minute, I've just been having a relationship with my mother mm-hmm. and she killed herself when she found out. Mm-hmm. So it would be just as horrific a thing to deal with today as it was then. Mm-hmm. And when you fall into that story of the Odyssey and his trip to get back to his wife and son, mm-hmm. you start examining things, and I go, well, hey, I'm trying to get back to my wife and children. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I'm seeing, oh, I know exactly how he was feeling. Or, oh, I didn't know I was feeling anything until I read what he was trying to do there or read someone's interpretation. And then you start to go, oh, well, there's more than one interpretation of the Odyssey. And you look at James Joyce, and then you start looking at poets like Margaret Atwood. And it's like suddenly you found the yellow brick road, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really fun to me. And another person was involved with the book that I've interviewed recently on the podcast was Ed Brisson.
Yes.
He did the book The Mantle, which I interviewed him for. And he does the lettering. He's not only is he like a writer, but he's a letterer.
A great letterer.
I noticed that his style of lettering is interesting. When Hector speaks, it's a very different font than when, quote-unquote, today people speak.
Yeah.
Did you guys work on that? Did he suggest that? How did you guys come up with the type you wanted to use?
Well, he's a really great collaborator in that he was open and he was a storyteller himself. So he was saying, I know that you have a voice for this guy. How do you want to express it? Have you thought about it? And so... Mm-hmm. I was able to share the few ideas I had and talk to him. We talked about great letterers that we had known, like wonderful people like Gaspar Saladino and that, mm-hmm. and certain projects. And so I was able to express some of the signposts or landmarks, and he had the knowledge and the ability to go, okay, I know what that is. I know how that's going. And yet we're working in a very, you know, it's not Gaspar Saladino with his pen working late into the night. And mm-hmm. so the technology comes in and it gives Ed different ways to express that. And so we came up with a lot of things. And then in some cases, he would come back at me and go, I don't think you've thought this through because this is happening. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, great. Thanks. You know, like, I'm glad you're here. Mm-hmm. And because I'm not a letterer, and although I might know a lot about it, it's not the same thing as being the person doing it.
Right. That's where a good collaborator can help make your thing better, because they understand the medium. They'll tell you when something doesn't make the best of sense to do it. And so that's a really great thing.
Oh, yeah.
So let's jump into the book itself. It's 130 pages. Mm-hmm. And it goes like wildfire. I was turning pages, going flip, 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 fast as I could, because I needed to know what was going to happen next.
That's good.
It's also black and white. And I'm kind of interested with the choice of black and white. Now, color might have been a lot more difficult, probably a lot more expensive, too. Did you guys choose black and white intentionally? Was there a reason that you chose it?
I always wanted black and white, mm-hmm. but I had considered having the end of it start to be color, so that when he does make it home, mm-hmm. that the color would come in and it would separate it more from his delusions and that, and give him more of a sense of reality in that. Mm-hmm. But talking with Greg and with Alexander about it and that, I could see that we didn't need to do that, that might be a little bit too heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it back and forth, and then just seeing what the initial stuff that Greg was doing with his black and white palette, mm-hmm. I saw that we really didn't need that. And one of the things that we put that aside, and then Greg came back with the idea of one sequence just being a letter from Hector to Penelope. Mm-hmm. And in there, instead of going into color and tinting it or anything like that, we realized that we could move from the comic form into prose and out of that. Mm-hmm. And it would give us the kind of nod to sanity, mm-hmm. that we needed in the story. And so we decided against the color.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, there are some people who think if it's not color, it's not worth buying. But a few pages into this, I completely forgot the fact that this was black and white.
Oh, that's great.
When you lose track of that and you're into the story, the color isn't important at that point, because you are drawn in and you're living this. And in a sense, it makes it live in that way, because we don't necessarily need the color to tell us what's happening. We're more reliant on what's taking place on the page, and we're more into the story to make that happen. So I really think that using black and white in this instance was a really good choice.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Now, another thing I liked at the beginning of the book, there's a very short verse on one of the pages.
Oh, yes.
It's called Father's Mirror. Did you write that?
Yes.
Okay. Because do you remember it? Do you want me to read it? Because I have it right in front of me. Or you can read it. Oh. Say it if you want.
No, go ahead.
It says, Father's Mirror. I would watch him at the glass, innocence observing ritual, sharp, clean blade, neck reaching out, then blood, then curse. And when I read that, I was really moved by that, because, you know, as kids, we kind of watch people, you know, our fathers shave and do sorts of things. And you're right about the business of being a ritual, and that he's using a blade. And then, of course, the business about his neck reaching out and then blood, and then he curses is probably what the thing that's happening there. And I came away with that thinking, wow, those kinds of things as a child really shapes our perception of our father. And so even for what I consider to be a very brief verse, it's really powerful. And I really liked it. It reminded me of my own dad.
Oh, that's great.
It was just spectacular. And of course, that's one of the concepts in the book, is the relationship of father to son. Mm-hmm. And did you draw on your own relationship to your own father, or was this kind of what you thought sometimes it is? How did you decide to tackle this topic?
Well, some of it was in trying to understand Odysseus, mm-hmm. and what he was going through, because I've come to the story at different times in my life and got different things from it. But at that time, I was trying to deal with losing my children and my wife. And I was questioning a lot of things about losing my father, mm-hmm. and what that meant, mm-hmm. and going over all the little things that you remember that your father said to you. And the poem was a first thing that I wrote, just dealing with things about my father and about how that there was sacrifices that were made, and that the sacrifices cost, and that sometimes the gifts that you were given from your father are a curse. Mm-hmm. And so I liked paralleling the fact that, yeah, it could be just my dad was shaving and he nicked himself and cursed. Mm-hmm. But it was such an archetypical thing and such a strong image of that intimate moment between my father and I. Mm-hmm. While he was shaving and blood. Mm-hmm. It's just the two parallels. And I was studying poetry at the time. I was really struck by a poem, I believe it's called In the Station of the Metro. Mm-hmm. And it was something like 14 words, mm-hmm. but it was all about the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And so when I was looking at that, I was thinking about the poem and trying to pack a lot of images into it and that. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things were little outgrowths of my exploration of, okay, you're a father, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You're also a man, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And so when I was writing Hector trying to find his way home, it was kind of me trying to find my way to someplace where I could be at home. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I never got back together with my wife. Mm. But there were things that I dealt with in doing that that helped me, I guess, have a little more insight into Odysseus. And I don't see him the same way I used to anymore.
Mm. Well, you know, it reminded me, there's a remorse I have or something unresolved with my father that I wish I could have always done. It reminded me very much of that. And it's going to sound somewhat simple, but it was a big deal. There's a Western show on the television when I was growing up called Gunsmoke.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad was a massive fan of that show. Every Monday night or wherever night it was on, he would sit and watch it. And I used to just rag on him. Dad, it's a Western. Nobody cares about Westerns. Why are you wasting your time on this show? And after he passed, we used to go out and visit my mother. And every Saturday night, 11:30, it was in syndication at that point. We would sit and watch that.
Oh, yeah.
And I came away going, I wish I could say to my dad, you know, I was wrong, Dad. It is a good show. You know?
Yeah.
I wish I could do that. And so it reminded me of that feeling in me about that and the relationship with my father. So, you know, in that sense, it's good to have those kind of feelings come up so I can deal with them again and do that. And when you talk about the relationship of fathers and sons, it really hit me on that. And it brought those kind of feelings back up.
That's what I was really trying to do. And I guess I was expressing, much as you were, the cost of those little things that happen so often into your life that you pay for the whole rest of your life, mm-hmm. but it's not a big cost, mm-hmm. but it's there, and it's a long time cost, I guess.
Yeah, it's something. And so I've been thinking a lot about that recently ever since I read the book. So I appreciate that when something brings me into a reflective mode where I can kind of examine those things. So that was something about the book that when I got done reading the book, I had to stop and think about that for a little while because it's important for me to go through those things when those feelings rise up again.
Oh, not just you, all of us.
Yeah. Now, another thing, we talked about the fact that they use photo references of you in the book, but there's also a lot of other people and some, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like godlike monsters or godlike characters. How did Greg do that? Were those chosen from like Greek, like drawings or something like that? Or did he come up with those on his own? How did he do that?
I think that probably from looking through a lot of the historical art mm-hmm. would be his jumping off point. But Greg loves monsters. Mm. If I could have put more monsters in the story, he would have been a lot happier. I was recently talking to some people about how a lot of what Greg was doing there was an art style that I was trying to develop when I was at university and that. But back then, we could only really do it with Xerox machines. Mm-hmm. And so it was very clumsy and stuff like that. And I had never played with it or developed it as long as Greg had. And he had given a certain finesse to it. So I think that some of the way he puts together his monsters is an alchemy that happens between him and his computer and whatever art inspiration happens to be hitting him at the time. Mm-hmm. And I can, as someone who's been working in Photoshop and for a long time, I can look at it and I can make some suppositions about it. But I never applied that part of my brain to what he was doing. I was just enjoying them.
Good. We'll take a brief aside here and talk about Photoshop, because as I was reading, you're a digital chameleon. You were one of the very first groups to deal with Photoshop, which now, of course, is a common thing. A lot of artists use Photoshop on their computers.
Oh, yeah. We were the first in the world to do that. There was some experimentation happening in the States and in Ireland with a different vector program that's probably a lot more similar to Illustrator. And when I came upon Photoshop, it was by mistake or by accident. And I saw, I was in for a demonstration of a vector program that was a paint program similar to Illustrator. And it wasn't really what I was looking for. But I happened to see someone having a demonstration of Photoshop as a production shortcut machine for the people that were in there were from one of those companies that, you know, travels around taking high school and grade school pictures. And they have to churn out a ton of portraits and that. And they need a quick way of doing all of the photo touch-ups. And the traditional way was so labor intensive that this was developed just for that originally. And I remember arguing with the salesman about, but I want to see that program. And he was like, but that's not a paint program. And I said, well, yeah, it is. And so he allowed me to play with it. And then we invested in it and we had to then take it and make artwork that could be done to the comic deadlines. Because when we first started working with it, the computers that were available then were so slow, gone. You could go and put on your kettle, go to the washroom, come out, pour your hot water into your tea bag, and then go back to your desk. And that save that you had started before all of that, you'd still watch the last of the bar going across.
Wow.
So it was way too slow. And we were lucky that after about a month of us developing things like doing the images and paying to have things at the end of print runs so that we could see that we were having trouble with kinds of registration and how it would reproduce and what would happen to the letters. And so we had to find resolutions that were acceptable. It was basically a three-month technical nightmare.
Wow.
And it would have ended with forget it, except that halfway through it, some guys who had been, I believe, were let go from Apple, started a small company, I think it was called 68,000, and they came up with a computer that was the Dash 2FX, which was a little box, but they turned it on its side and put some fans in it and cranked the clock on things so that we could press save and it would take a second to save. It was like, okay, we're in business.
Wow. Do you still use Photoshop, by the way?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I haven't learned yet.
Because I'm convinced that Photoshop can do so much now that no one person can know everything that it does.
You would be right.
I'm just amazed by it. Let's get back to the book for just a couple more minutes. An interesting part of it that I really liked was the part where Hector kind of runs into some people who become his crew. He perceives them as his crew from the ship. And there's this one great sequence, and I don't want to spoil it. It's fun to see, where they basically decide to get on the ship, as it is they do, and they go through, and all of them take off together.
Yeah, well, they're a crew.
Yeah, and it's so fun when they go along, and they continue to stay with him for quite a while, and they kind of help him out as he needs. And the funny thing is they listen to his stuff, and as he talks about things in sort of Odyssey language, they interpret it into modern things that are happening to them.
Oh, yeah.
Which I liked, because a lot of people these days, if you try to do something like that, a lot of people aren't really willing to go the extra mile and work with you and listen to what you're saying and kind of interpret it. But these guys are. They're very interested in kind of hanging around with him and doing things because there's things that they think that he can do for them, which I like. And it's a really good sequence. I really like that. He learns a lot from it, too, because now all of a sudden he's not alone. And his perception of what's going on is really great. And I love that whole sequence. When I got to that, that was one of my favorite parts of the book. It was just great.
I'm sure you loved his ship.
Yes. It was great stuff. Oh, it was wonderful. It was good. And I can't possibly spoil it because you got to read it. It's really good.
Well, the thing that I was going through there was I've been from time to time when I was, well, especially when I was younger, I had a difficult growing up. And in a lot of cases, I ran away from home a lot and lived on the street for periods. And the thing that I remember about talking to the people that you would meet like that, they were dealing with all kinds of monsters. just like Odysseus was. And you had to listen to what they meant rather than what they said. Mm-hmm. And being a grammar Nazi wasn't going to get you anywhere. And I kind of had that attitude from, of all sources, Doc Savage. Mm. I remember reading when I was very young, my father was a comic collector and he liked the pulps and that. And I remember reading Doc Savage when I was really young. And there was a thing in there where I believe Monk and Ham were talking about Doc, and they were talking about how he was so intelligent that he could speak to anyone. And they didn't mean any language, they meant anyone. And I thought, well, so that's something that I should emulate, because that was a sign of intelligence. And so I tried to be open to that. And I know I was in an odd situation once where I spoke to some newcomers to Winnipeg who were from Greece. And their English was very broken. And so part of what we were talking about was hand signals and things. And yet I got along with them great. And I don't think they knew everything that I was saying, but they knew what I meant. And so I have that in Hector, that he does have that in himself. And so that when he does go to those people, they get him. And even as Odysseus, he's speaking to them, not at them. Oh, and the really interesting thing about that is when Gregory went to do the photo reference in that for Under the Bridge and that, he ran into a group of people that were living under the bridge. And he was afraid to take pictures at first because he thought, well, this is their home. They're not going to want me coming in here. And they asked him what he was doing. And he said, well, I'm working on this comic. And I was taking, and they were like, what do you want us to do? And he was like, oh, I can't take pictures of you. And they were like, no, no, go ahead. You want to do this? And so the group that, with the few pictures that you see of them under the bridge and that, that was some people that were living there.
Wow. It's funny how when you do these projects, people will get on board. As long as you're doing something that's really creative or something, a lot of people will try to help but make it happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that when you start to think creatively, your brain goes to a different place. And so the rules that normally you're following walking down the street don't really apply anymore.
Very cool. Really, really cool. Now, there's two other things I really want to touch on quick before I let you go. There's a resolution between a female agent or policewoman. Don't want to spoil those kinds of things. But she really takes Hector for granted and thinks that because he's not quite functioning in the world the way that she thinks he should, she can get away with stuff around him.
Right.
But he is not going to let that happen. And he does some really interesting things that even with his perception of the Odyssey going on around him, he's able to communicate what's going on about this stuff. And I don't want to spoil it, but it's a really good thing. And he really brings that to a resolution real well.
Oh, thank you.
I really like it. And then the last thing I really like, of course, is when you mentioned a little earlier about the business about getting back, going home. And his resolution of that circumstance, and of course, I don't want to spoil that either because that's the end of the book and that's a strong exclamation point to the book. And I just think you have to read it. His devotion to his family is something that even somebody that might be stronger than he is, he's able to overcome because of that.
Yes.
Which I thought that was such a great way to end the book. I just thought, you know, and then there's, I'm so tempted to spoil all this because there's wonderful touching moments going on in there. But there are things that happen having to do with the family, and there are sequences and scenes that I really liked that really, you know, I just sat there and went, oh, you know, when certain things happen because there are things having to do with his own son. That really got to me and really touched me. So it ended so well. When I got to the end of the book, I was like, oh, nuts. I could have read another 100 pages of this because it's so good. It was so well put together. So I want to tell you that the ending is really terrific. And the book pulls you quite along at a rapid pace. The art's strong. Everything makes you want to read it. If you're a Long John's guy and that's all you can really do, then, you know, you'll probably want to stick to that. But if you like variety like I do, if you want something that's creative and different, it will expand your understanding and give you a different kind of storytelling, then Underworld is really for you. And I really think you guys did a terrific job on it.
Well, thank you from both of us. I agree with you that Greg did wonderfully on it.
Now, as far as if somebody wants to get a hold of Underworld, I understand it's released, but of course you guys are in Canada and we're down here in the United States. Those of us down here in the United States, or even some people in Canada, may not have access to it. How do you get a hold of Underworld?
I believe it's available through Amazon, but I know that Diamond has copies as well.
Okay. So somebody could have your local store go and order it for you.
Yes.
Okay. So that'd be good. So that's a good way to do it. Is this out digitally as well?
Not as yet that I know of.
Okay. Because one of the things that helps people if they can't find a paper copy of something, and not every store wants to invest money in a trade paperback, which might cost a little more. But as far as, I hope it goes on to Comixology or something like that, because that would maybe be helpful to people who may not be able to get it through their local store.
Well, as far as I know from the other books that I've done with Renegade, that was the path. So I imagine that's going to happen at some point. We've been discussing, Greg and I have been discussing when it does go there, doing similar to what John Bolton and I did on Shame, where when you downloaded the digital thing, there was an interview with us just talking about the making of the book that was attached to that. So we would certainly want to do something like that to encourage people. And one of the other things I wanted to say was I was really, really happy with the foreword by Mike Carey. He saw right through it. It was really great.
It was wonderful. I was reading that, and there was all kinds of wonderful discussion of what the book was going to be about, really profound. And, you know, he's a writer himself, so he nailed just about everything in the book, I thought, really, really.
He's such a great writer.
Yeah, so good. Now, I just looked up on RenegadesArtEntertainment.com, which is their website. You can order the hardcover there.
Yeah.
For $24.99, you can add to the cart and you can order it nailed. I'm sure there'll be postage and stuff involved, and shipping and handling and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
But you can get this, and there's a duotone cover. It's kind of black with bluish coloring involved on it, too. So it's a little different on that. But I really recommend it, especially with the holidays coming. It's the perfect time to get something that your comics friends or anybody who may like something like this, something a little different, be able to pick this up and get it, put it under their Christmas tree. I think this is the ideal book to get. So I really think that you go to RenegadeArtsEntertainment.com or stop by the local bookshop, tell it's Underworld. And it's coming out from Renegade Arts Entertainment, and Lovren's name on it. I would definitely order it, and hopefully it'll be there. So it's a great book, and I really recommend it. And Lovren, by the way, if they haven't gotten Shane yet, they could always get Shane, too, which I think is a good book. So there's a lot of good stuff. Are there things you're working on, too, that we should know of that's coming in the future?
Actually, John is busy painting the next Shame trilogy.
Ooh.
This one's called Hope.
Ooh. Read that.
And nothing prepared me for the first few pages that John has done on that.
Oh my.
It's John told me something. We were at a convention in Calgary, and he told me that he would be happy to continue to illustrate Shame's story exclusively for the rest of his life. And I was like, wow.
Wow, so, that's a compliment for you. Wow. That's good stuff. Now, it's John Bolton, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I want to make sure we get his name in there, too, because the first two that I read were really just gripping. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. So it's good stuff. So if you get a hold of Shame, ask him for that. If you have to go to the website and do those things, go and do that. It's definitely worth it, and it'll come to your house, and you'll be able to read it. And, boy, that was again, I talk about variety. That was something I have never read before, and I was so happy with that. I love to see something I haven't read before.
Oh, well, that's what I keep trying to do, too. I keep trying to fill the in-between places. When I wrote, I don't know if you're familiar with the Tarzan stories that I wrote in the collection called Le Monstre. Mm-hmm. I wish they had called it The Monster, because I think a lot of people look at that and think it's a French book.
Oh.
But when I wrote those, I was looking at what Burroughs did and writing the stories in between. Mm-hmm. So when Tarzan came out of the jungle and D'Arnaud took him to Paris, where he caught a boat to go over to the United States, there was time where they were waiting for the boat. So, boom, I have them go to the Paris Opera and just happen to bump into the Phantom.
Wow.
So I guess I'm really drawn to those spaces that happen in stories everywhere, whether it's, an Edgar Rice Burroughs story or the story of my life. There's spaces that are so pregnant with meaning that there's those stories in there, and that's what I'm trying to deal with.
Are those Tarzan stories available these days?
Yeah, the trade paperback is on Amazon.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
It's still got a bunch of them to sell.
Oh, good, good. Because I'm going to be after that. That might be my Christmas gift to myself.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you like the old, I'm trying to remember the production company that put out the film, but the classic movie monsters, I've got the first two issues that I wrote was a Phantom story, The second one is the Frankenstein monster, and the third one is Jekyll and Hyde.
Oh, cool. Oh, cool. So I have to get these because I really have enjoyed your work, and I really want to read some more. So it might be my Christmas list. I'll have your name on it.
Oh, well, very nice. I would hope you would enjoy it. I'm very proud of them.
Well, good, good. Well, Levern, you're doing wonderful stuff. I really appreciate it. And doing stuff through Renegade Arts Entertainment is really great. Thanks to Alexander for setting up the interview and for the chance to talk with you. And I can't wait to read your other stuff. I really do. I just, again, the book is Underworld, and I highly recommend it. Whatever you can do to get it, I recommend you get it because it's a great story, and it'll be something that'll make you think, which is something that reading ought to really do more of. So I think you're doing a great job, Levern, and keep it up, and maybe we'll get to talk with you again sometime.
Oh, that would be nice. Thank you. It's been a really great experience.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.